microphone.
You need a microphone so it'll be recorded.
Hey, you did that.
I guess that everybody knows me from, well, not everybody, a lot of people probably know me from the blogging community, but I'm guessing some people don't, and bloggers are nothing if they aren't narcissists, so I'm no exception to that. So I'm going to start by telling you a little bit more about myself and why I'm interested in this topic. By the way, I've got a great little quote here from... What? My husband's in the rescue. We'll get to him soon. Anyways, I've got a great little quote from Bruce McConkie here. It says, "The way to find the true religion and the pure gospel is to find out what Jesus and the ancient apostles taught." I agree with you, Bruce. Let's go find out what the ancient apostles and the early Christians taught. Can we go to our second slide? I'll give you a signal or something. That's what hasn't worked, my slides. Okay, so I'm going to talk about me. That was me when I was like 2, and I put that in there because I thought pictures would be entertaining. Oh, by the way, I could have just stood here and read my paper, but I thought that would be hella boring, so I'm just going to summarize what I present in my paper, and I hope that works for you. About me, I consider myself an evangelical mutt. That means that I come from a lot of different Protestant traditions. I've attended a lot of different denominations. And I recently, just in June, I joined the Evangelical Covenant Church, which is a denomination that doesn't really take a position on anything. So they're not anything. But like, if you want to baptize your kid as an infant, you can. If you want to wait till they're older, you can. They do both infant baptism and believer's baptism. So there's no pressure to baptize as an infant. They do both. Things like that. I've never been Mormon, just in case you're wondering. I don't have any members. I don't have any relatives in the LDS Church other than the ones I married into. And I did my undergraduate degree at Brigham Young University because I'm a glutton for punishment. And because I'm really a glutton for punishment, I seduced one of your worthy priesthood holders and got married to him. And he's right here working my slides. And as was already mentioned, I'm a student at TEDS in Chicago. So let's move on to why I'm interested in this topic. Now, I want you to know something about this picture right here, this picture that has the female pastors on the cover. It was very controversial in the Bible Belt. Some Christian bookstores pulled it from the shelves, and others had it. You know that black magazine cover that you put in front of your porn magazines? Some of them had to put the little porn cover out in front of the female pastors. Anyways. So this is serious business. But within evangelicalism, there's basically two different positions. There's egalitarians, and those are the people who are, they're kind of like evangelical feminists. They believe that women can be ordained as pastors, and they support women pursuing their lifetime callings and goals. And that's what I am. And there's generally what's called complementarians, though they sometimes go by different names. But broadly, there's this group of people who don't believe in ordained. What's so funny?
We're still struggling with the light.
It's okay. It's okay.
You guys, just ignore it.
It's fine.
You should have brought a flashlight, people.
You're turn on your cell phone.
I'm a member of Christians for Biblical Equality. I'm not going to go into too many details here, but there's basically two Protestant feminist groups, a more liberal one and a more conservative one. The more liberal one is called the Evangelical and Ecumenical Women's Caucus, and the more conservative one is Christians for Biblical Equality, and I'm a member of CBE, and I contribute to their blog occasionally and do other things for them. I have an article on Mormonism and Mormon women coming out in the next issue of their magazine, Mutuality. So, but we believe that women were leaders in the early church and that they can be leaders today, and so we're going to talk about some of the evidence for that and how Mormons might interpret that evidence. So, we're going to start out. Oh, this is a little, okay, so women and Mormonism. I put a little quote up here. You probably can't read it, but it's from the current Old Testament manual, which is being used in Sunday schools now. And it talks about Deborah, and it says, "Deborah, the strength of a righteous friend." Deborah, she's not a prophet, she's not a judge, she's just your righteous friend. And I put that up there because I think that that shows that the church is really uncomfortable with these examples of powerful women in the Bible and in the Old Testament especially. So I think that the church, when it talks about what it would like women to be or gives examples of biblical women, it tends to focus on women who are wives and mothers. You don't get a lot of talk about Deborah or Miriam or just other examples of women kind of breaking out of the mold in the Bible, which there's a lot in the Old Testament, well, less in the New Testament. But I'm not going to focus on the prophets today because I think there are they're just the subject that they're on. I'm going to start with the New Testament period. So I called that paper More Precious Things, which should be an obvious reference to Joseph Smith said that he was restoring plain and precious things. And I'm going to cover the New Testament era and onward. And we're going to talk about the evidence for women as apostles, bishops, elders, priests, and deacons. We're also going to talk about some of the other female ministries briefly, widows and house church leaders. And we're going to talk about, we're going to cover the evidence that women were performing baptisms and administering the Eucharist in the early church. The reason we're covering these things is because they're things that Mormons associate with holding the priesthood today, though we don't know for sure that that would have been the case in the early church. But we're going to cover that women were doing these things in the early church. And we're going to discuss why these things were done away with, and because things eventually, most of the Christian world eventually switched over to all-male ordination. And then we're going to talk about how what Mormons can do with this data and a couple different interpretations of what Mormons can use. So, there's a couple of different types of evidence that we're going to cover. We're going to start with the New Testament data plus patristic and canonical commentaries on these texts, because they kind of shed background and light into how early Christians interpreted these texts. Then we're going to talk about other early Christian texts that mention women leaders, church canons, letters, biographies. We're going to talk about inscriptional evidence, dedicatory inscriptions, funerary epithets, things like that. There will be a little bit of visual evidence here, which is where those pictures come in. Artistic depictions of women. Yeah, you can read my PowerPoint, right? And we're also going to talk about polemical evidence. Now, this one needs a little bit of explanation, because when the church fathers wrote about something and they got angry about it and they condemned it, it was because somebody was doing it. The church fathers, they were like Obama. They didn't believe in preemptive strikes. So when they come out and they get angry about women performing baptisms and say women should not baptize, it's because women are doing it. So that gives us evidence that women were doing it in the early church. I just need to let you know, though, that an error that people are always making when they discuss this data is that they read it anachronistically, and my own paper's a little guilty of this because I had subtitled it Evidence for Women's Priesthood in the Early Church. We don't actually know that all these things were the priesthood. You know, I used an LDS term to describe this data, but that's because the titles are notoriously hard to come up with, and I needed something that would make you come to my sessions. but, I mean, what'll happen, though, is, like, we're going to get to Phoebe in Romans 16 in a second, and people will look at Phoebe and see that she's a deacon, and they'll say, okay, well, in the 3rd century, the Stromata says that deacons were just ministers to other women, so Phoebe was just a minister to other women. No, we don't know that. I mean, Mormons of all people should know how much a church's polity can change in 100 years, let alone 200 years. So later evidence doesn't necessarily tell us how things were in the 1st century church, but it's still worth looking at, because they could be preserving a valid tradition, or, you know, it tells us about women who lived 2,000 years ago who were pretty awesome and deserve a little recognition. So it's worth pointing out for that. So we're going to start with Romans 16:7. We'll kind of start at the top and talk about apostles. This is a pretty famous passage in the evangelical world right now. There's a lot of controversy and discussion of it. And the passage simply states, "Greet Andronicus and Junia, my relatives who were in prison with me. They were prominent among the apostles, and they were in Christ before I was." Now, a lot of translations, English translations, will translate Junia as Junia, so implying that that's a male. And other ones will say that they were well known to the apostles. So those are some of the later ones that have just come out because of this controversy. Basically, there's 3 different points. I cover this all in my paper, and I'm not going to summarize it too much today, but people debate whether or not it was really a woman. But I mean, I'm biased, but I think the egalitarians have this one locked up. they debate whether the text should be translated prominent among the apostles, meaning Junia was an apostle, or prominent in the eyes of the apostles. And they debate what an apostle was, because they say, oh, it could have just been a messenger, you know. Junia was great among the messengers, something like that. But we're going to go now to one early patristic commentary on the passage, though. John Chrysostom, who wrote on Junia in the 4th century, he said, "To be an apostle is something great, but to be outstanding among the apostles, just think what a wonderful song of praise that is. They were outstanding on the basis of their works and virtuous actions. Indeed, how great the wisdom of this woman must have been that she was even deemed worthy of the title of apostle." Now, of course, he's writing about this several centuries later. He didn't know Junia. He didn't know what her function was. But it shows that early Christians read this text and understood that Junia was an apostle of some sort. We don't know what Junia's function was either. It could have been an authoritative office. Maybe it wasn't. But it's still intriguing evidence to look at. So it could have been a Roman apostle in the early church. Deacons, Romans 16, 1 through 2. It says, I commend to you our sister Phoebe, a deacon of the church at Gentria, so that you may welcome her in the Lord as is fitting for the saints, and help her in whatever she may require from you. For she has been a benefactor of many and of myself as well. Phoebe was Paul's letter carrier. She took the epistle of Romans to the church in Rome. There's also a passage in 1 Timothy 3, verse 11, basically. But he gives the requirements for deacons. And then he suddenly stops and says, women likewise must be serious, not slanderous, but temperate, faithful in all things. There's a lot of modern translations today. That part that says women, they'll translate between wives. What the Greek text actually just says is the women. It doesn't say female deacons. It doesn't say wives. And a lot of modern English translations, because we're coming from an era where the female deaconate was gone, they don't want it to be talking about female deacons, so they'll translate it to say the wives. But as we're going to see, most of the patristic commentaries on this passage understood it to be talking about female deacons. On my next slide, I'm going to quote Origen, who was preserved in Latin by Rufinus. That's really unfortunate because we don't get to read the original Greek, which compare it to some of the terminology in the New Testament. But anyways, he says, I commend to you Phoebe. This passage teaches by apostolic authority that women also are appointed in the ministry of the church, in which office Phoebe was placed at the church that is in Gentria. Paul, with great praise and commendation, even enumerates her splendid deeds. And therefore, this passage teaches two things equally and to be interpreted, as we have said, to mean that women are to be considered ministers in the church, and that such ought to be received into the ministry who have assisted many. They have earned the right through their good deeds to receive apostolic praise. So it's a pretty strong commentary on this order of female deacons that existed in the early church at the time of Origen. John Chrysostom commented on 1 Timothy 3:11. He said, some say that he is talking about women in general, so even at the time it was debated what exactly was meant by women. He says, some say that he was talking about women in general, but that cannot be. Why would he want to insert in the middle of what he is saying something about women? But rather, he is speaking of those women who hold the rank of deacon. Deacons should be husbands of one wife. This is also appropriate for women deacons. I assume he means wife of one husband. For it is necessary, good, and right, most especially in the church. So there's actually several commentaries, but just going to read with them and say that these were female deacons being referenced. Are we just going to go with the lights on or what?
No, they're fixing.
Oh, I have another one up here. Okay, this is Theodoret of Cyrus, but I think I'm going to run out of time if I read every single one of these. So he says the same thing. He says that 1 Timothy 3:11 is talking about deacons. I think there's maybe one commentator who took it to mean wives of deacons. Anyways, other women leaders in the New Testament, we're not going to spend a lot of time on them. They deserve time, but I just don't have time to cover all this stuff. There's an order of widows described in the 5th chapter of 1 Timothy. He talks about widows who needed the help of the church, and then he talks about enrolled widows. It was a women's ministry of some sort. We don't know if they were ordained. We don't know what their function was. But it was a women's ministry, and it exists in later church periods as well. There were also house church leaders, female house church leaders all over the New Testament. There's Lydia, Nympha, Chloe, Priscilla, and possibly the elect lady and her chosen sister in 2 John. Most people think that refers to the entire church, but it could be a female house church leader as well. In her book, When Women Were Priests, Karen Jo Peterson argues that female house church leaders, since the early church met in house churches, and these female patrons who took over and hosted congregations were more or less functioning as bishops, pastors. They were the overseers of this church. And it's significant that they're named by, when the people in the New Testament talk about them, they refer to it as Chloe's people. They call the congregations by the names of these women. Do you want to go back one, Annie? Back. You're giving away my presentation. There we go. There was also an intriguing little passage in Philippians 4 where Paul pleads with Euodia and Syntyche. I should not have pronounced that because I was a classics major, but I don't. Theodoret of Mopsuestia, I didn't put the quote here, but he read this as a struggle between two women for church leadership, local church leadership. So that's intriguing that apparently in that time they saw this as a... Some people have suspected that they were each house church leaders and their houses were near. Something like that. We don't really know, but it is intriguing that Paul pleads with these two women to get over their struggle, or else it's going to tear apart the church. post-biblical data, the early patristic data on female deacons and deaconesses, I think what I've cited on Romans 16 and 1 Timothy 3 already shows that it was very common for there to be female deacons in the early church. But we need to distinguish between diakonos, which was a Greek masculine common gender noun, and diakonissa, which, you know, it sounds like deaconess is the feminine form of the word that was developed later in the late 2nd, maybe early 3rd century. They're different. The diakonos, female diakonos, or diakonoi, might have had the same job as male deacons, we don't know. Whereas diakonissa was later developed into its own order with separate functions and jobs from the male deacons. So that didn't come about until later, though. But I'm just going to call them all female deacons for the sake of brevity. So we have abundant references to female deacons and deaconesses all throughout the East, mostly, though there are some references in the West. It would be impossible for me to even list it. I mean, it's just all over the place in early church writings. Wives of male deacons were generally not given the title of deaconess. There's a couple of examples counter to that, but later on when we discuss wives of elders were sometimes called female elders, so that gets in the way of our data. But most of the time when somebody refers to a female deacon by that feminine word, they're actually talking about the ecclesiastical office. We don't have to worry about maybe this was just the wife of a deacon. Descriptions of their function don't start appearing until the late 2nd and early 3rd centuries. And how am I doing on time?
Fine.
Okay. I've got a lot of slides to get through. I'm going to read you a little description, though, of what exactly female deacons were doing from about the 3rd century onward. This is data collected from about the 3rd through 5th centuries on what their function was. The role of the female deacon as a special ministry to women is briefly described in Didascalia, and in more detail in the apostolic constitutions dependent on it. Assistance at the baptism of women, including anointing of the body of the female convert, pastoral visits, and religious instruction with women, welcoming and maintaining order among women at the assembly, and travel and authorized representation of the church. They were the liaison between women and the bishop and accompanied women who visited him. But these canonical descriptions do not explain all the textual references. For example, the activity of the deaconess Lampadion in Gregory of Nyssa's Life of Macrina, who evidently was some kind of leader but not the monastic community superior, or the references in Justinian's novella, I will get to that, to both men and women's apparent participation in sacred rites and administration of, not assistance at, baptism. A close study of some of the literary sources fleshes out the description better. Female deacons prepared women for baptism and offered them hospitality during the transitional time before and after. They provided hospitality and protection to socially vulnerable women. They were advocates and agents for lay women in the church. They traveled with women pilgrims. They embarked on pilgrimages themselves. Some were monastic superiors. Some were trusted teachers. Others were members of monastic communities, but not superiors. Some supervised important centers of pilgrimage. Others lived in their own house. They supervised liturgical roles of women and led them in liturgical prayer. In 5th and 6th century Edessa, some canonical texts grant that religious superiors and women who were deaconesses performed a variety of liturgical roles, even to the point of pouring the wine and water into the chalice at the Eucharist and doing other actions in the sanctuary in the absence of a priest or deacon. Next, we're going to talk about the Fractio Panis. We're going to talk about a first bit of visual evidence here. This is a great, gorgeous picture. This is dated. It's a fresco. Where is it at? It's at the Catacomb of Priscilla in Rome. And it's dated to the late, I've got a cramp in my toe. It's painful. It's dated to the late 1st or early 2nd century. And Dorothy Urban, who's an art historian, has argued. Now, a lot of people, this is visual evidence, so different people look at it and say, yeah, that looks like guys to me. But Dorothy Urban, who's an art historian, has looked at it, and she has argued that all 7 of these figures were women. But the big point is, what's the identity of the person down there at the end of the table? Because he, whoever it is, has their arms outstretched in breaking the bread of the Eucharist and giving the blessing over it. Dorothy Urban has argued that the skirt is too long to be male, and she has argued that the hairstyles match those of known women in similar pieces of art from the time. You know, other people are going to look at it and say, no, those look like men to me. I've heard other people talk about beards on the people. I'm like, what beards? But it's a very intriguing piece, and it would be cool if it was women, because it's so early in it. Shows these people administering the Eucharist and celebrating it together. So, let's go on. We get some later references to women performing the Eucharist. If pregnant women could not attend the assembly on Sunday, deaconesses could take the Eucharists to them in their home. This is later on in the 5th and 6th century. There were three Gallic bishops who chastised two priests for allowing women to assist in the Eucharist and burn polemical evidence there. And in Edessa, deaconesses could distribute the Eucharist to their female companions who lived in convents. So later on, there were definitely some cases of women performing the Eucharist and administering it to other people in whole or in part. Well, they may not have said the blessing over it. I don't know. We don't get that information. There were definitely women performing baptisms, though. Okay, if you haven't read Acts of Paul and Thecla, you need to, because if that story isn't true, it should be. It's about this woman named Thecla, who's a virgin, of course, but somehow she's always finding herself naked throughout the text. Putting her clothes off and throwing her to lions and doing things to her. But there's this part in the story where she's like, I think it's time for me to get baptized, and she throws herself into this pool with sharks in it. And God protects her from the sharks. It was sharks or eels, or maybe it was a mutated sea bass. Ill-tempered mutated sea bass. But she throws herself in, though, and performs a baptism on herself, which we have a self-baptism in Mosiah in Alma. He baptizes someone and dunks himself at the same time in Alma. What's that reference? I'm not wearing my glasses. 18, 13 through 14. Anyways, Tertullian was pissed off about the Acts of Paul and Thecla. He had this passage where he rails about women performing baptisms in his day in the 2nd century. Very, very upset how this text apparently spurred women into doing this. In several texts as early as the first half of the 3rd century, female deacons are described as assisting with baptism. And this should be interesting to Latter-day Saints. Baptisms are usually done either nude or almost nude, so they would get the women to anoint them. The male priest would usually anoint the head of the female convert, but they would get the women, the deaconesses, to come and anoint the body. Some say they did it before baptism, and some it was after. They would anoint them with the oil. And some say that the priest would do the baptism himself, and other texts in different places say that it was the women performing the baptisms on other women, because it was improper for the priest to be touching a woman who was wearing that little of clothing. So, what's my next slide? The Didascalia Apostolorum. Now, these are texts, ones from the early 3rd century, and these are highly developed texts which describe church government from these periods. In the 3rd century, this is what it said: we do not approve of women baptizing or of being baptized by a woman, because this is unlawful and a great danger, both to those who baptize and those who are baptized. Later on in the 4th century, now the Apostolic Constitutions was basically a revision of the Didascalia, and it changed some things and added some things, but they've actually softened this, and they say, now for women performing baptism, we assure you that it is no small risk for those undertaking this. Therefore, we do not advise it, for it is perilous, rather uncustomary, and irreverent. But these texts do show that women performing baptism was a concern for the church at the time, and the councils came out against it. This is a reference to Justinian. This is very interesting. He says, this is a novella. It's later on 6th century, but it says, it talks about ordaining deacons, and it says, thus they arrive at a sacred ordination, whether they are virgins or have been married to one man. We do not allow those married twice or those of notorious life or under any suspicion to approach the sacred deaconate or administer baptism to those who present themselves and to participate in other secret rites and most sacred mysteries that they are accustomed to practice. He talks about deaconesses performing secret rites and most sacred mysteries. I'm sure Latter-day Saints probably love that, but some people think that he's talking about the administering the Eucharist there. But he's definitely talking about women administering baptisms. What happened to the female deacons? In the West, they were never very popular. There was a lot more oppression of them in the West, though we still have inscriptions and things that talk about them. But three church councils in the West over the 5th and 6th centuries came out and condemned the practice of ordaining female deacons and got rid of it. So we have very clear evidence of the church trying to stamp out the practice of ordaining women deacons, even though it was very, very common and testified to in the Bible. In the East, it kind of just died out because infant baptism, in part because infant baptism became the norm. They didn't need women to baptize adult converts anymore. And we still find much later references, though, in the 8th, 9th, 10th centuries and beyond, which refer to the old orders of women deacons and affirm that they did exist. I'll cover one of those towards the end of my presentation. So, we're going to talk about female elders next. There's far less evidence for female elders and female deacons, but there's still some compelling mentions. There's actually a little bit more evidence for female elders in the West than in the East, unlike with deacons. And we have 15 known inscriptions referring to women who are called by the feminine form of elder. However, we do know for a fact that the wives of elders were sometimes called by the term. So every time that we find an inscription that mentions a female elder, we can't be 100% sure that she had some kind of liturgical or sacramental role as an elder. However, there are still some compelling inscriptions in places where we can be pretty sure that it's talking about ecclesiastical leadership of some sort. So we're gonna go and talk about some of those. Okay, this is one, Guldi Aruna, Presbyter of Hippo. This is a mosaic in the Church of St. Augustine in Hippo. It's dated to about the 5th century, and it says, Guldi Aruna, Presbyter, rest in peace, lived for 40 years. The prominence of her title in the subscriptions, and this inscription suggests that she was a recognized leader of some kind in her community. So that's a very, very pretty, intriguing piece. This is Lita, the Presbytera. It says, sacred to her good memory, Lita the Presbytera lived 40 years, 8 months, and 9 days. Her husband made this tombstone. She preceded him in peace on the day before the Ides of May. 4th or 5th century from Tropea, I don't know where my glasses, Tropea, Calabria. Her husband is mentioned, but he's not honored as an elder. It used to be that everyone looked at this and they were like, this is the wife of a deacon, because it mentions her husband right there. But then some other people looked at inscriptions where elders mention their wives, and they always honor themselves as elder and call their wives beloved. So they argue that this is probably actually meant to honor a female elder, and there's some other evidence from the area that indicates that there were female elders in that area. Flavia Italia and Martia, this one is from the 5th century also. It's an inscription on a sarcophagus in Dalmatia. It says, under our Lord Theodosius, consul for the 11th time, and Valentinian, most noble man of Caesar, I, Theodosius, bought a burial tomb from the matron, Flavia Vitalia, holy presbyter, for 3 golden solids. Now, this is intriguing because we know from other documents that elders in this area were in charge of brokering transactions, real estate, property transactions. So this was a woman who's referred to with the natural function that we know that elders had. There's a graffito from Poitiers, France.
Poitiers.
Huh?
Poitiers.
I don't ever say these things. I just read them, so I can't pronounce them. Anyways, it dates. We don't know the dating on it. It could be as early as the 4th century. It could be as late as the 6th. But it says, Martia the Presbyter made the oblation equally along with Olybrius and Nepos. So it talks about her performing the Eucharist with these guys, these male priests. In the Council of Laodicea, I should have went through and looked this up before I came into this. Canon 11, 4th century, concerning those who are called presbytides, or female presbyters, or female presiders, it is not permitted to appoint them in the church. Later on, I'm going to show you some other evidence that this is, in fact, he's not just talking about old women or something. He's saying, stop ordaining, or the church council here, they're saying, please stop ordaining women as elders. We'll get to that in a minute. Okay, this is way late, probably much later than Mormons are really interested in. I'm sure that a lot of the 5th and 6th century evidence Mormons aren't really interested in. But it's such a famous piece that we're going to talk about it. This is the Episcopum of Theodora. It's in the Church of St. Praxedes. And it's dated to the 9th century, about AD 820. And it's an inscription. There's 4 women here. And the one with the square halo around her, that indicates that she was still alive when the inscription was set up. And it says over the top of her, Theodora Episcopa. And her husband is mentioned in other texts. He was not a bishop, so this is not the wife of a bishop. She was the mother of Pope Paschal I. And there's some marks over the A in Episcopa, where Vandals tried to scratch off the A to obscure her gender. So it gives us evidence of people trying to blot out some of the evidence for women in ecclesiastical positions. Very, very famous piece, though. You'll see it all over if you actually study this stuff. There's a couple of other inscriptions. Here lies the venerable woman, Bishop Q. It says Episcopa Q, buried in peace for 5, maybe, years. It's a damaged inscription. That's in the Basilican Cemetery at Rome, dating somewhere between the 4th and the 6th century. They're uncertain. Canon 20 of the Council of Tours in the 6th century mentions an Episcopal attorney. And a 5th century fragmentary inscription is dedicated to a priestess in Solon. There's a cross on the inscription, so we know that they're talking about a Christian priestess, not a pagan priestess. and it says, they use both the Old and New Testament and also speak in the same way. Oh, in case you aren't familiar with church history, the Montanists, they were a heretical group, but they're known for having a kinder attitude towards women, and their reasons for being willing to ordain women are very intriguing, and most of what we know about them comes to us from hostile sources who were upset with the Montanists. So, Epiphanius of Salamis, he says, they use both the Old and New Testament and also speak in the same way of a resurrection of the dead. They consider Quintilia together with Priscilla as founder, the same as Cataphrygians, I know how to pronounce that. They bring with them many useless testimonies, attributing special grace to Eve because she first ate from the tree of knowledge. They acknowledge the sister of Moses as a prophetess, as support for their practice of appointing women to the clergy. Also, they say Philip had four daughters who prophesied. Often, in their assembly, seven virgins dressed in white enter carrying lamps, having come in to prophesy in ecstasy. Can you go to the next slide? I mean, the quote continues.
Project.
Yes? 5 minutes? Oh, right. Okay, we gotta hurry up. They pretend to weep as if showing the grief of repentance. Okay, he keeps on going, though. Oh, and women among them are bishops, presbyters, and the rest, as if there were no difference in nature. So I thought that was a fascinating passage because he says that one of the reasons why they were okay with ordaining women was because they thought it was a good thing that Eve had eaten from the fruit first, which kind of parallels well with Mormonism. But, okay, I'm almost done. Why oppose the ordination of women? When people discuss these things in modern debate, they will often quote, they'll quote the church fathers and show, hey, look, they were quoting these passages in the Bible. They were complaining that people who ordain women are blurring the differences between the sexes. That's not the only reason the church fathers were opposed to the ordination of women, though. All over the place when you read about them. They talk about the inferiority of women and the weakness of the sex. Women are being perpetually punished for each sin. They frequently refer back to the fact that Eve ate from the tree first, so women don't get to be ordained. And they would regularly argue that women were ritually impure due to menstruation, and that's why they couldn't be ordained. Augustine, for example, I didn't put this quote up, but Augustine said that the only reason women exist is so that they can bear children. Women do not exist for companionship with men because men would rather hang out with other men. That's stupid.
I agree.
The Bishop of Vercelli, he gave us a really interesting passage. I guess that this is going to be my, I'm not getting to the part where I explain how Mormons can take this data. I'm just going to summarize what he says. He had people writing to him, asking him, what about these earlier canons that talk about women being ordained as deacons and elders? And he basically goes and looks at them and he says, it's true, they did used to be ordained as deacons and elders because the church needed them. And women are holy and they're learned, and the church had a need for deacons and elders wherever they could get them. So the church was ordaining women. He basically agrees with what I'm saying, except he says, then when the church spread and became more institutionalized and became a bigger institution, they didn't need women as elders and deacons anymore, so they stopped doing it. But he affirms, this is in the 10th century, but he affirms, looking back at earlier evidence, everything that I've said here, including that canon 11 of the Council of Love. La, la, la. That's
last year.
Yeah, I'm so professional. Anyways, let's try to have a really quick how LDS people can take this data, though. I think that's my last slide. Okay, as I said, there's three ways that Mormons can look at this data. And this is the most common response I get when I try to talk to your average rank and file Latter-day Saint about this data. They'll just say, we don't really care what the apostate Christian churches were doing with women. That was, most of this data comes from after the window when Mormons believed there was an apostasy. So what do we care? I would say that you should care because these churches could be maintaining authentic earlier traditions from the Christian church, and you should care because some of this data comes from the Bible itself, not from apostate Christian groups. We can use it as a polemic against Joseph Smith. We can say, hey, look what Joseph Smith forgot to restore. And be not very nice with this data. But as I see it, though, this data does not have to threaten even Mormons who accept the church's current teachings on gender roles. The church has the 9th article of faith, which says that God still has things to reveal. I can't even quote it. I'm not a very good non-member. But it says that God still has things to reveal. And there isn't any reason why Mormons can't believe that women held some kind of priesthood back in ancient times and that it was lost in an apostasy and that God has yet to restore it. So I don't see why the state has to threaten Latter-day Saints. You guys have a beautiful tool for accepting this stuff and adding it to your arsenal. So I don't really see why people have to be shy about it. Anyways, I guess I'm probably out of time, and it's time for Maxine to respond to me, so I hope you liked my presentation.
absolutely love Bridget's paper, and I had the advantage of reading the whole 24-page paper, which has twice as much material as her presentation. I was so excited to hear about this session and see her work. I discovered you on the web, I think, about 6 months ago or last fall, and was excited about your blog. But I'm really impressed with her thesis and also her review of the literature, the Christian canonical references, but especially the post-apostolic early church father period. She's assembled a wonderful collection of references. It's really impressive. And I'm impressed with her thesis, which of course I love because I pursued it myself when I became Gnostic. I mean, that's one of the reasons why, one of the two reasons why after my excommunication I went to Gnosticism, partly because my personal inner path matched what I saw in the Gnostic tradition of texts, but also because I wanted to immerse myself in those early, you know, Christian origins and early Christian version of women's participation in Christianity. I wanted to really immerse myself in that as my spiritual path and my clergy path, which was denied me in Mormonism. Not entirely, it's there in Mormonism, but to some extent was denied. So I was very excited to see her thesis that Mormon feminists could benefit greatly from examining textual sources on women's roles in early Christianity in all three periods, the canonical, the apostolic, and the early church fathers. And I think, her paper, I agree with 99% of it. I think there were only two statements that I probably took issue with partly, which I'll mention those. But I think she starts off saying in her paper that there hasn't been anything written about feminist theology since Women in Authority because of the repressions and excommunications. And I think that's partly true. Few women have dared to venture into theology and priesthood issues since Women in Authority, although women have talked about and written about and published feminism, about Mormon feminism since then. And, in a number of books. I mean, Janice Allred's God the Mother. Of course, Janice was excommunicated. And Bridget said there have been no church members, you know, Latter-day Saint members, who are willing to engage this since Women in Authority. Well, Janice engaged it beautifully, but of course she was excommunicated before she published the book. Mormon Sisters, which engages feminist theology to some extent, was republished in 1997. You also have Religion, Feminism, and Freedom of Conscience by George Smith in 1994. Again, they engage feminism, but it's feminism. It's not feminist theology per se. An interesting text is Beverly Campbell's book on Eve and the choice made in the Garden of Eden. That's a fascinating text where a Mormon woman engages feminist theology in a safe way. I think Dorothy Solomon also engages some feminist theology in The Sisterhood, her book in 2008. And there are others, please forgive me. Susanna Morrill, a little bit in White Roses on the Floor of Heaven. I think her work is really important. But I think she raises a crucial point that Mormon women have been afraid to engage feminist theology or issues of priesthood because of the repression of the September 6th. There was another issue in there I lost. Oh, well. She also makes the statement that the early church didn't ordain women to the priesthood. In talking about Mormonism, that it didn't explicitly ordain women to the priesthood. And I think there are examples in the language, particularly from the 1842 Relief Society Minutes, where Joseph makes his statement that everybody, Linda Newell and everybody has quoted since, that he was establishing or helping to establish the Relief Society, who would elect its own president and its own officers and would ordain them to preside over the society just as the presidency preside over the church. And if any officers are wanted, let them be appointed and act apart as deacons, teachers, etc., as are among us. So there is that statement of precedent in early Mormonism that kind of evokes, that statement and others evoke a little bit the notion of early Christianity, or Christian origins. Gosh, I got so many notes here. She also makes a statement that I'm going to have to skip a lot of this. that, you know, that Mormon women cannot be prophets, apostles, elders, bishops, priests, high priests, or deacon, nor can they perform baptisms or administer the sacrament. So in contrasting the role of women in Mormonism with early Christianity, which Mormonism claims to restore, you know, Bridget is setting up a really important, you know, highlighting a really important dichotomy that Mormonism claims to restore, you know, primitive Christianity, the original church, and yet Mormon women are not allowed to function in the roles that are mentioned in the canon and other sources. And yet, you know, I presented a paper at the Mormon Women's Forum back in 1996 where I found precedent in Mormon history for women to have functioned in every single role from deacon to president to prophet. And again, I agree with Bridget because overtly women are not given those offices for the most part in Mormonism, neither in Mormon history, 19th century, or contemporary Mormonism. And yet they function in those roles. There are examples of women serving as deacons, teachers, priests, elders, mission presidents, apostles, goes on and on. And I'll have to present that paper again sometime so I can enumerate all of that. She also, you know, another way that I think women function in the role in contemporary Mormonism is the role of the bishop. Kate Holbrook gave a wonderful presentation at Claremont last year. I think it was entitled Looking for a Female Bishopric, or Finding a Female Bishopric. And she talked about examples of how Mormon women actually function in a role as bishop. And if you really take seriously the notion, the early Christian notion, as the episcopos, or bishop, as the overseer of a household of faith, women in Mormonism fulfill that role all the time. I tell Judy Dushku all the time she's a bishop. There are all kinds of examples of Mormon women functioning as an overseer of a household of faith. Interestingly, just this spring, and I didn't have time to look it up, Julie Beck, the New Society president, gave a speech where she said that every Mormon woman, mother, was the lioness of her home. Fascinating reference. That a Mormon woman determines everything, everyone that goes in and out of her home, and she is the person who oversees and presides and makes decisions about everything that happens within her home. Well, that's a bishop. That's a house. A household of faith, and that's a bishop. I also like the term lioness, because if you think of Brigham Young as the Lion of the Lord, then a lioness would be a prophetess. I think if you get away with that. The lioness at the gates of her home was how she put it. So again, these are examples of how Mormon women, I think, function in the role without the title. Also, Bridget made a point of saying very little consideration to women's roles in the New Testament and the early church has been given by Mormon feminists who are trying to make a case for women in priesthood. And she says that that's an unfortunate oversight. And I agree. There's so much material there, particularly when you realize that that's the basic premise of Mormonism as the restoration of early Christianity. And yet there are women who have actually engaged that topic in a number of ways. Margaret Toscano in Women in Authority engages the notion of presbyter and elder and beautifully in that essay. Go back and look at that. I've engaged the topic of early Christianity and women and precedent in Sunstone Talks and Moonstone Columns, and I talk about it in an essay that's coming out in a book next month on the September 6th, and other places where I've talked about it. And I've been working on a paper about that since I got involved in Gnosticism. I just haven't published the paper yet. Jerry Hurd has talked about women's roles in the Bible. I mentioned Kate Holbrook. I apologize to everyone I'm forgetting. I know there are women who have given fascinating papers at Sunstone, and there are a few pieces in Sunstone magazine that engage this. But I think the sense is that I think Mormons do, Bridget makes the point that Mormons haven't noticed it or haven't explored this, and they have. And I think particularly Mormon scholars and students and liberals and feminists have noticed this and talked about it at Sunstone and various forums. But, and I think conservative Mormons have noticed this, but I think the issue is they don't feel empowered to articulate theology or the relationship of women and priesthood, and I think that's actually the problem, not that they haven't noticed it. I'm just skipping through really fast. There are so many notes. Her paper is so rich that I hope you publish it soon. So if my comments seem disjointed, it's because I'm jumping around. She made some really interesting comparisons between early Christianity and Mormonism, and I thought of one that jumped out at me during the purge of 93. When Elder Packer's famous talk in May of 1993 talked about the three greatest threats to the church, he referred to the so-called intellectuals. And I remember at that time, all I heard was Irenaeus talking, you know, against heresies, talking about the so-called Gnostics. It was eerie. I felt like I was hearing, you know, history repeat itself. Let's see. I'm going to have to skip over so much. I want to get to your... there's a point she made here, and actually Margaret would be the person to respond to this, but if we get time. She quotes Karen Torgerson, whose book is wonderful, about how the more that early Christianity became public, the more that women were repressed. So that it's interesting that as religion goes public, the women had to stay more private. That's a complex issue in early Christianity and in Roman culture, and Margaret is the expert on Roman religion and culture and its relationship to Christianity. But there's a lot, we could talk a whole session about that alone. I'm going to have to skip over it, but there's a lot going on there. Okay. I need more time. Anyway, I'm going to skip to, in the paper version, there were a couple of women you left out. So when in talking about the precedent in the canonical New Testament, there are many examples of women having those roles that are sort of priesthood-type roles, beginning with the notion of disciple. Because the disciples are not distinguished in a way. The male and female disciples are all disciples, and there's no distinguishing between their role in a way. And women, Mary, the mother of Jesus, Magdalene, and of many, it says many women, were part of the disciples. There's an interesting precedent there in the discipleship, because originally the women who are the disciples are providing means, food, shelter, means for Jesus and the disciples. Well, that's the origins of a house church. That indicates that they're providing food and shelter, and so they're gathering, and these women are providing this space. That gets formalized with Peter when they begin to use Peter's house as the house church, but it continues post-Jesus, particularly with Lydia. I was going to bring up Lydia in Acts, because she and her whole household are converted. Everybody in the household, and the word household is used. And then she invites the apostles to come and stay with them. I read that as an episcopos, a bishop of a household of faith. But the role of disciple itself is I think, an important role. And Anna the prophet, who foretells the birth of Jesus, and his role, that's a prophet and also in a way the first witness of Jesus, so that's an important precedent. And of course the Magdalene as an apostolic or an apostle, a witness of the risen Lord. You mentioned Phoebe, you mentioned Priscilla, that kind of covers them, but I wanted to just mention those. I'm going to have to skip. I'm going to skip all that. I'm going to keep going here. I also wanted to mention, when we talk about early Christianity, it's sort of which Christianity? Are we talking about the John Jesus movement, the movement in Judaism? Are we talking about the Jewish Christians, the pillars of Jerusalem, Peter, James, and John, the close associates, the apostles, family members, Ebionites, you know, the Jewish Christians? Are we talking about Paul and the Pauline movement? And so we're talking about three different movements there, and women's roles within each of those movements of Christian origins, as well as Gnostic movements that pop up are interesting and unique within each one. I've looked at that, and you know, and again, this is a whole other topic there isn't time for, but they change. And Paul, who has often been accused of being sexist, was actually a great champion of women's roles in early Christianity. He's the one who's acknowledging and validating deacons and priests and fellow missionaries. The Paul and Thecla story, the Thecla epic, is a really important feminist text, not only because she's a fellow missionary and a companion with Paul, but she's celibate, which is a feminist act in that time period, among her other great acts. But I think during the John Jesus Jewish movement, I think there's something interesting happening there. I think that in a way, Jesus is doing something similar to what Joseph Smith is doing in early Mormonism. And before I go into that, I just want to respond to Bridget and say, I think Mormon women needed to find their own history, their own origins of authority within their own tradition first, which has involved decades of work by feminist theologians and historians. And then I think we're able to explore into their connection or their authority as posed by early Christianity. But I think, to try to summarize quickly, in early Christianity, in the Jewish movement that John and Jesus are Mashiachas, Messiahs of, Jesus is operating within the cultural constructs of his tradition and his religion. So the Council of 12 is really a Council of 12 elders representing the 12 tribes of Israel. As much as I would love to believe that there was a woman among the Council of 12, I don't think there was. But at the same time, so he's operating within his own framework. And at the same time, he's resisting it and breaking out of it by including women and treating them as equals and sort of shifting so that both are going on at the same time. I see Joseph Smith doing the same thing. He's shaped by his time period. He's operating within, and this is responding to one of Bridget's statements in her paper that, you know, Joseph Smith set up an utterly patriarchal church. Well, I don't think he did. And a lot of us feminists, Margaret and others, have notably, Linda Newell, have shown that he didn't. But Joseph is utilizing the sexist forms of his time and at the same time resisting them and breaking out of them and including women in new ways that are shattering the existing conventions. So I'm probably out of time and I had a lot more to say, but did I mention the Didache? One last thing. The Didache is an interesting source. I love it. I use it for communion because it does not tie the interpretation of bread and wine to body and blood. The wine is the vine of David, and the bread is the souls of all who God has scattered. Like the broken bread, God has scattered all of us across the world and is gathering us back together in communion. The Didache is really interesting because the Didache, or rule, which could have been written, depending on whether you're an optimist or a pessimist, anywhere from the 50s CE to 100 CE, was the guideline or the rule book, sort of like the church handbook for the early Christians. And it makes no it uses the male gender, he, in many places. But when it talks about prophets, apostles, presbyters, and Christians, and electing for yourselves bishops and deacons. Bishops and deacons doesn't use sexist language of he or she. Christians and apostles and prophets uses the word he, but he is the universal he throughout the document. So when I read the Didache, I read it as a document of equality, because the few places where he is used is universal. And where he is not used is very telling, because it's in the clause, the verse that talks about choose among yourselves in a democratic way bishops and deacons who are true and faithful. Anyway, those are just a few thoughts. Thanks for indulging me, and I'd like to see a lot more work on this, and I hope that the paper I've been working on, I'm going to cite you all over the place. I'm looking at the early part, not the not the apostolic fathers or the early church fathers. But I'm really excited by this paper, and I want to see a lot more work on this. Thanks, Bridget.
We just have time for maybe one or two questions if anybody wants to ask, and maybe you need to come up to the microphone in the middle and talk right into it.
There's been a fair amount of work done on the diminishment of women's administration in the early LDS church, and there are some obvious parallels in the diminishment that you documented in this paper, and I wondered if you had done any specific comparisons or parallels between those two.
Not within the paper, though I'm pretty much aware of them, having read, I read Women in Authority when I was like 17 in high school. I thought it was a great book. This is when I first started studying the LDS church. It might not be the best book to read when you're just starting studying the LDS church, but Anyways, I think there's a lot of parallels there, and that women used to be prominent in the movement, and their power was gradually taken away as the movement spread. But no, I didn't try to document. They're just such a different time period, and I think that the reasons why they were taken away were so different. I didn't really try to, in the paper, document the parallel there. Anyone else?
I was surprised you didn't talk a little bit more about Mary Magdalene. I thought she's one of the early church leaders that dates back to the time of Jesus. Is that in your paper?
It's not in the paper, and I believe, could be remembering wrong, there's some early church references that call her the apostle to the apostles, don't they?
Yeah. Yeah, it's in the church fathers. It's not in the...
Okay.
Yeah, it's an apocryphal.
I think Mary Magdalene was amazing. She's one of my favorite biblical women, but I didn't talk about her because she didn't really... Apostle to the Apostle seems like such an honorific title to me, rather than actually implying that she was an apostle, so I didn't really include her.
I had more I was going to say about Magdalene, because I think Magdalene is someone that Mormons do take notice of, and I think that she actually kind of works for them as a model, because she has a vision of the risen Christ, mm-hmm. as does Paul, and as does Joseph Smith. So she's an apostle by visionary experience. And Anne Brock's book, Anne did her dissertation at Harvard, and her book on Magdalene the Apostle is a really good book. But I agree with
something
it.
I'll keep in mind as I revise the paper, though. Are we done?
Anybody else? One more? No? Then we're done. Thanks for coming.
Thank you.